With these guys, Warren, like you've rattled off their names between Jack Twiggy, Brett, Mr. Lee, and Singo as well. Geez, if you lost them money, gee, they'd be a bit pissed off, wouldn't they? Do you ever get nervous dealing with these big high net wealth, or you're pretty confident by the sounds?
It was very transparent from day one. Mr. Lee's guiding principles were rule number one, never lose Mr. Lee's money. Twiggy is a bit of a difficult boss. He's a bit of a difficult taskmaster. Not everyone can survive that trial by fire. I figured if I survive trial by fire with Mr. Lee, I can survive it with Twiggy.
G'day, money miners. Today is the 6th of September?
It is the 6th. Wednesday,
6th of September, and it's great to be in the Money of Mine Elite Studio.
It's great to have you here, Ali. We've got a special show in store.
And we thought this show would be right up her alley. So that's why we got her in.
I see you writing these down last night, thinking them through. Mate,
we just had an absolutely cracking interview.
I'm so pumped to share this one.
Live from Hong Kong.
We interviewed Warren Gilman. So Ali crossed paths with Warren at Argonaut, and he's quite well known in and around the mining, finance, mining, investing community. Why don't we crack into his background a bit?
Yeah, so I mean, the short way to sum up is he was advisor to the majors and now fund manager to the billionaires. That's sort of the intro for him. But
an elite few billionaires.
Elite five.
So 64% of Queens Road Capital, the fund he now manages, is held by Brett Blundy, Andrew Forrest, as well as Jack Cowan, all Australian billionaires. And in the past, he managed CEF Holdings, which was a mining investment fund that was jointly held by CIBC and the wealthy Chinese billionaire Li Ka-shing. So he invested over...
He refers to him as Mr. Li.
And he invested over $500 million through the sort of 2010s period in mining projects all around the world.
And he mentioned he also invests for John Singleton. East Coast folks that know about Singo. Well, renowned in... He's in the rugby league. He wasn't in, but he was in the horse racing world. Yeah, very prominent figure.
Yeah, well-known Australian business person as well.
Yeah, more marketing background. Went head-to-head with Kerry Packer a lot, I think.
Yeah, that's right. So it was a cracking chat. We covered his background, what he's doing now, how he likes to invest. QRC have a very specific style. They love to use convertible notes, and we go deep into that as well as the project he rates, the projects he doesn't rate. So I'm pumped to share this one.
Well, JD, before we do it, because a lot of it is about con notes, just give a bit of a definition for the money miners. You'd class a con note as in between a capital raise and borrowing money off a bank. It's sort of the smack bang in the middle version. How would you define a convertible note, JD?
Yeah, so they are a debt instrument that has equity characteristics. So they're a hybrid. As Warren emphasises, they pay a coupon, they pay an interest rate, and he likes to keep that optionality to convert them at a predetermined price into equities. So you get, in his words, the best of both worlds.
So you get the money up front as if you're borrowing it from the bank, but then there's the option for that to then be converted into stock.
Yeah, so that price there is predetermined, and that's often almost always in the case that he uses at a 130% price of whatever the current share price is. So you're converting that at a premium to the current share price. But on the flip side of that, you know, you've got that coupon coming in, which, as he elaborates on, he can use to pay out to his shareholders as a dividend.
All his rich shareholders. So, and I think the way he summed it up was, like, if you do an equity raise, especially in this market, you could be raising at a 20 to 30% discount. Whereas if you go via this convertible note method, the way that they do it, you're technically getting it at a 30% premium.
50% difference.
So, and a 50% difference if it's a 20% discount on the cap raise. So
you get the money in the door, you don't have that dilution, but you do have to pay out a clip of capital every quarter to the investor.
And I suppose on the downside for companies, we've seen is that clip of capital, if they haven't got the money coming in, can be a hindrance.
Tough.
Absolutely. That's the downside of this type of tool.
And he's, so that, and they, I suppose ASX ASX relevant is Adriatic Metals.
They, and Challenger Exploration as well, the two companies that are listed on the ASX in which they currently have investments.
And look, we'll get into it, but he's got a big focus on the ore bodies, quality world-class ore bodies, and they've got a big filter test they go through for these condos. They don't just give them to everyone. So
sure does.
Right, let's get into it. Now, partners today, Anytime Exploration, bloody mate, great friends of the show, true friends of the show.
They are.
If you need any an exploration geo, a driller, a person on your exploration project, hit them up. Also, soil sampling, core cutting, anything, anytime, anywhere, exploration services, give Seamus Murphy a call.
Absolutely. Our first sponsor, so thanks a lot, guys.
Oh, it's all been
GCs of the mining
industry. Yes, good work, Ali G. Righto, let's get into it.
Here we go.
Warren Gilman, here we go. Righto, money miners. Here it is, live from Hong Kong. Gee, talk about getting all around the world. JD's given a great pump up before this, and we'll introduce him to the show. Warren Gilman, how you going, Cobber? Welcome to Money of Mine.
Well, thank you very much, Matty. Pleasure to be here from exotic Hong Kong. And I used to live in Perth, so it's been a while since I've been to the Grand Metropolis, but I used to hang out at the King Street Cafe quite a bit.
Oh, beautiful.
Very good, mate. Now, it's good to have another mining engineer on here, Warren. I was one in a previous life, sort of failed miserably. Where'd you do your mining engineering?
Yeah, no, I'm the same, Matty. I failed miserably as well, so I had an alternative course of employment. But I went to Queen's University back in Canada, and I lasted all of a year as a mining engineer. I got laid off twice in that year, twice, and I had to find a steady source of employment. So after that, I joined a bank, and I was at a bank for 26 years. So the banking industry was a little bit more stable than the mining industry.
Your journeys are probably a bit different to mine. Mine failed more of my 'cause of my office decorum. My language is more suited to the underground mining environment, so they sent me down there instead.
Warren, I'm keen to touch on exactly what you just said there. You've worked all around the world, obviously Perth, you've grown up in Canada, you're based in Hong Kong. I'm keen to hear how Perth and Australia differs from the other parts of the world as it relates to mining finance.
You know, Perth is a great place for mining finance, JD. You know, when I was there, it was the turn of the century. It was the internet boom, and gold was $200 an ounce, and you couldn't raise a dime for anything. And that's really how I wound up in Hong Kong. The bank said, "Warren, this mining industry is over." You might recall the term back in those days, Rust Belt industry. We didn't need a rust belt industry like mining anymore. So you may as well go up to Hong Kong and look after this fellow Li Ka-shing. But, since that time, almost perfectly coinciding with me leaving Perth, Perth became an absolute boom town and the punters returned. And it's been not a bad period of time since then. It's not just Perth, all of Australia. It almost seems like in the last 10 years, the Australian capital markets have supplanted London and supplanted Toronto, and it has become the source of mining finance, not just from the punters, but also from mega Aussie institutions who are very interested in the industry. One of the few places that is still interested in the industry, oddly enough.
Yeah, so we're just touching on, you mentioned Li Ka-shing, Warren. You've had a number of highly successful billionaires back you, including Mr. Lee, and now you've got Andrew Forrest, Brett Blundy, and Jack Cowan backing you in Queen's Road Capital. How did you attract the support and interest of these billionaires?
Gee, Ali, that's a great question. No one has ever asked me that question before, and I'll probably take a little bit of thought to answer it. I think each one is different. You know, when I first convinced Mr. Lee, what was it? It was probably 15 years ago to start investing in the mining industry. When I first approached him, he was very negative. He said, "Look, Warren, I don't know anything about mining. I don't have a single mining investment." He says, "Metal prices go up and down, and there doesn't seem to be any great logic or predictability to it. I don't control any of it." And if you know Mr. Lee's investment style, he likes to get into industries that he can have some sort of, shall we say, influence on. But the mining industry was perhaps a little bit too big, especially with LME traded commodities. So he said, "Look, I don't really see why you think I should be an investor in the sector." And I responded, "Mr. Lee, I appreciate everything you say. It's absolutely true. But the main driving force behind the mining industry now and for the next century will be China. And there is no single person on planet Earth who understands China better than you, and no single person on planet Earth who understands whether the Chinese economy is actually in expansion mode or in a decline mode. So all you need to do is tell me whether I should put my foot on the gas or put my foot on the brake. I'll pick the mining assets," because you're right, you don't know anything about mining. I'm the mining engineer sitting in the room. "But you sure can tell me whether now is a good time to be buying or selling. And together we make a pretty good team."
Warren.
And to his credit, he saw the logic of that. And before I left the room, he said, "Okay, let's do this." And we started investing. So that's the short one on Mr. Lee. You know, Andrew and Jack and Brett Blundy and John Singleton, they all have similar sort of stories. But I think it's all convincing, a matter of convincing them that they have something to add and they're not just going into this as a quote unquote punter.
I think John Singleton wouldn't mind a good punt with his racehorse ownership. I think it's probably better safer money with you. With these guys, Warren, like you've rattled off their names between Jack Twiggy, Brett, Mr. Lee, and Singo as well. Geez, if you lost them money, they'd be a bit pissed off, wouldn't they? Do you ever get nervous dealing with these big high net wealth, or you're pretty confident by the sounds? I'd be myself.
Well, Maddie, it was very transparent from day one. Mr. Lee's guiding principles were, rule number one, never lose Mr. Lee's money. He didn't mean in the long term, or he didn't mean in Aussie or Canadian dollars. He meant every year in US dollars, you have to make me money. If you don't, rule number two was, "Oh, and by the way, you don't get my capital for free. You have to pay me a dividend every year." So pay me a dividend every year, never lose my money. "Oh, and by the way, I want unlimited upside. I've got to have, you tell me there's a lot of money to be made. I don't want you telling me, well, we were capped out at 10% or 20%. I want big scores." So I want big scores, never lose money, and get a dividend every year because I need to feed my kids.
No pressure, hey.
And if you don't do that, guess what? Every Christmas, you either get to go back to your office or we get to walk you home to your home and see you later. So you might say it was a trial by fire. But after doing that with Mr. Lee for 10 years and never having a down year, paying him a dividend every single year, and giving him some great scores along the way, you know what? I sort of trial by fire. I got used. That's what I do. And so that's what we're doing at Queen's Road.
And so you thought it'd be a good idea to get another four of him involved just to have the same arrangement.
And one can never have enough friends. But, you know, Mr. Lee is, you know, as everyone in Perth has seen recently, Twiggy is a bit of a difficult boss. He's a bit of a difficult taskmaster. Not everyone can survive that trial by fire. I figured if I survive trial by fire with Mr. Lee, I can survive it with Twiggy.
Well, mate, you're getting a pat on the back from money of mine because, mate, you've got some minerals to go into that. So well done.
Warren, I think that's the perfect sort of segue. The lessons you learned there at CEF and going into creating Queen's Road Capital. What is Queen's Road Capital about? What's the structure? It seems like a lot of the characteristics that you use to invest are now utilized by QRC. Can you tell us a bit more about how you like to invest, how the fund is structured?
Quite right. So very simply, you mentioned CEF. That was the name of the company that I ran for Mr. Lee. That was our vehicle for investing in the mining industry, investing his money in the mining industry. And given his requirements, obviously, which I've just emphatically stated, his three rules, I had to come up with some way to invest in the industry that would achieve all of those three goals. And obviously, buying common shares of a mining company doesn't fulfill any of those things because, you know, you're not going to get a dividend. Nine times out of 10, the stock goes down as quickly as it goes up. It's a high, high risk business. So we don't do that. We developed a structure to invest in convertible debentures. And why convertible debentures? Because it fulfills Mr. Lee's three rules. We don't lose your money because we're a debt holder, not an equity holder. We pay a dividend every year because the coupon on the convertibles give us a coupon, which flows right through to our shareholders, and we pay a dividend at the end of every year. And we have unlimited upside. If the equity goes up, the value of our convert goes up. And it's not capped at all. It's unlimited upside. So the convert structure works perfectly for fulfilling Mr. Lee's three requirements. And when we decided to wrap up CEF and create Queen's Road, the business plan of Queen's Road was simply more of the same. We've done this all before. We used to do it just for Mr. Lee. Now we're going to do it for all Queen's Road shareholders, but with the same vision, the same plan, which is we don't lose shareholders' money. We pay you a dividend every year. And we give you unlimited upside to the equities of the companies that I invest in. And we've seen that it's a business model that works. And we will continue to stick with it.
These investee companies, Warren, what criteria, what's the sort of go, no-go approach with certain criteria that you're looking at when making an investment decision for these converts?
Ali, it's really simple. It's all about the ore body. We have to have a great ore body.
That's a great place to start.
Yeah, I mean, that's the must. After that, various other criteria fall into place. But if we don't have an ore body, a great ore body, we don't even look at it. So, you know, number one, people say, well, Warren, you must have a big staff and you must review 1,000 properties a day and or through the course of a year, and it must be a daunting task. Well, no. The staff is, there's three employees at Queen's Road, including myself, and one of them's a CFO, so she doesn't do any of the property assessment. All the property assessment is done by myself and my colleague Alex Granger. And that's simply because there aren't that many great ore bodies in the world. And they're certainly not being discovered very, very quickly. So the challenge during the course of a day is to try to find a great ore body it's a bit of a needle in a haystack, but obviously you don't need to turn over every rock because, you know, 99% of the time, the quality of the ore body isn't there. But once you do identify a high quality ore body, then some other considerations kick in. Obviously, there's no sense getting exposure to a great ore body if it's in a country where you won't be allowed to own it in the long term. So it's got to be a great ore body, but it's got to be a great ore body in a place where you can build it and own it. So we're very geopolitically risk averse, as was Mr. Lee. And you want it in a commodity that has some upside. You want the wind at your back and not at your face. So, you don't want to go into an industry, even if you have the greatest ore body, you don't want to go into one where the commodity is going to be in chronic oversupply. So you tend to avoid those things, even though they might be great ore bodies, because, the upside is significantly reduced. But yeah, it all comes down to point number one, which is quality of ore body to begin.
So honing in on that ore body is how much of a driver is the current, I guess, macro environment, the commodity prices today? Like, let's say you found a brilliant copper zinc ore body, whilst those prices are a bit deflated at the moment, but or is the actual geometry of the ore body, the depth, the thickness, the tons and ounces per vertical meter, what would you class as some of the most important things when you are making that categorization, irrespective of location?
Yeah. Matty, nothing beats grade.
Grade is key.
Grade is, as they say, grade forgives many sins. And you can make a lot more mistakes mining an ore body that's very high grade than you can with one that's low grade. So we love grade. So not to say that we wouldn't do lower grade stuff. And, maybe grade is too blunt a term. Maybe it should be better vocalized as margin, because, using uranium as an example, you can have absurdly high grade like NexGen and the Arrow deposit in the Athabasca and produce at $5 a pound and have tremendous margins. But the Kazakhs are also producing at $5 a pound with grades that are 1/100th of that. It's still possible to do with quote unquote low grade if your processing costs are a lot lower. So perhaps I should qualify that and say margin is the best thing to have.
So if you're gonna pick off the top of your head five ore bodies right now around the world, irrespective of location, of some of the greatest ore bodies we see today, like based on geometry, grade and everything, what are some of the, I guess, the first five that come to your mind?
Oh boy, no one's ever asked me that one either. That's a great question. Beyond Arrow, which, not to plug my own investments, I am long and therefore highly recommend, as the saying goes. But Beyond Arrow, which is, one of the greatest ore bodies I've ever seen, things that come to mind are things like, Grasberg. You said, let's leave geography out of the picture. Well, if we can leave geography out of the picture, Grasberg is obviously something that's just in a league all by itself. And then you think of things like what is it in Japan, the old Hikari mine that's still in production, the high grade gold mine that's several ounces a ton that's been going for 100 years for Sumitomo and is still going. Yeah. No one thinks about Japan as a gold producer, but that ore body is, talk about margin. I mean, it's just and goes forever. Those are totally unique ore bodies. and they don't come along very often. And if you can have a chance to get a piece of something like that, it's not just a company maker, it's an industry changer.
Warren, I want to get into a detail on your investment style around the convertible notes, and that is security over the assets. Is it a must that QRC gets security over an asset before making an investment?
Just the opposite, JD. All our notes are unsecured. So when I go to a company and say, look, yes, it's a piece of debt, but it's an unsecured piece of debt. Yes, we rank above all the common shareholders in your capital structure, but we will rank below traditional debt holders. So when it comes time for you to actually build your mine and you raise project finance, we're not an impediment to that because we are gladly subordinate to all senior debt holders. So we are unsecured, but we do have provisions that protect us so that other than senior debt providers and traditional senior debt providers, you can't have any other convertibles, you can't have any other debt without our approval. So unsecured but protected.
Okay, interesting. And going deeper on the con notes, I want to hear about the thought process behind actually exercising them. How do you go about deciding when's the right time to turn that debt into equity?
Great question. 9 times out of 10, I'll hold the converts to full maturity and beyond. So that usually means 5 years and beyond. Why? Because it's such a wonderful structure. You have total optionality on the upside of the equity that you're investing in, but you're still receiving this coupon. So if I were to exercise my right to convert prior to the maturity of the debenture, I'd be losing out on getting that coupon every year for the next 5 years. So I tend, even when we're well in the money, I tend to hold on to that just because I like receiving my 9% or my 10% on a quarterly basis.
Keeps Mr. Lee off your back too.
it allows me to keep Mr. Lee happy and all the shareholders dividend. Now, I should emphasize that our structure allows us to convert at any time and convert as much or as little. So if I have a $20 million convertible, I can convert $1 million of it and sell those shares into the market if I want and keep the other 19. I can do that any day of the week through the whole 5 year period. So if the stock goes crazy for what I think is going to be a brief period of time, I do have the flexibility in the structure to realize on that. I tend not to do that though, because I'm a partner with the company. I'm their partner for at least 5 years, maybe more, and I don't want to kill any rally in the stock. So I've never done that, but I just wanted viewers to know that we do have the ability to do that if the opportunity arose and we thought it was the right thing for our shareholders to do.
So, Warren, I think we just have to ask, why are more mining funds not using this type of investment?
Yeah, I think you're going to see more and more of them will be. You have to have a certain faith in your ore body. You have to have a management team that understands that we've got an ore body that can withstand paying Queen's Road 9 or 10% on a coupon every year. So, as I said, that eliminates 99% or, 95% of every company out there because they just don't have the quality of ore body that we're seeking. And then there's a lot of CEOs out there who just don't want to have the coupon as a burden on them every year. But if you are a true believer in the value of your deposit, if you can't create 9% of value every year, then maybe your understanding of your deposit is not quite what you thought it was, or maybe you don't quite have enough faith in your management ability to develop this thing, because surely most of your investors are looking for greater than a 9% return. So it's a bit self-selecting in terms of quality, which again is a great thing for us, makes our job easier. Only the best quality deposits and good quality management understand the value of the convert. But if you understand it and if you have that quality ore body, it's a no-brainer in terms of raising money through a convert with Queen's Road versus doing an equity issue. Because an equity issue is dilution, dilution, dilution. And Queen's Road is all about minimizing your dilution. Every single one of our converts, every single one of them is convertible at 130% of the market price at the time of our investment. So that's a 30% premium. We see guys in the market right now in Australia doing equity deals that are at a 20% discount.
Oh, geez, even more than that.
And they're paying their broker 4, 5, 6, 7% commission on top of that. So net to the company, that's 25, 27% below market versus issuing equity ultimately to Queen's Road at a 30% premium to market. That's 50% less dilution by doing a deal with me versus raising money in the market. It's a no-brainer. The math is a no-brainer. As long as you have the quality of the deposit that warrants our financing.
You mentioned Warren Australia. And at the minute, QRC doesn't have any investee companies in Australia. Is it the lack of opportunities or the lack of quality ore bodies, or you just haven't found the right one yet? Or is it somewhere you're looking to head into?
That's a great question. We do have two investee companies that are listed in Australia. We've got Adriatic, which is ASX listed and London listed, and we've got Challenger, which is ASX listed. But you're correct in that we don't have an investment in a company that has an ore body in Australia. And you know, Mr. Lee used to ask me the same thing, because Mr. Lee, as you know, is a huge investor in Australia and other industries besides mining. The three mobile network and, the power companies, Power Core and ETSA, and he's big in power distribution throughout Victoria, South Australia, New South Wales, etc. And so he used to call me up and say, Warren, I've got the premier of New South Wales on the phone, and he's trying to convince me to invest in this mining project. And gee whiz, Warren, why don't we have any mining investments in Australia? Australia is one of my favorite countries. I'm a big investor there. Australia runs on mining. Why don't we have investments there? So I have experience in answering this question, Ali. And the answer 10 years ago is the same as the answer today, which is Australia is a bit of a hothouse, as you guys would understand. You know, it's like little green tomatoes getting red very, very quickly because you've got intense sun shining down on your glass roof. It's a bit of a closed shop, and everything in Australia is more expensive than anywhere around the world. So my response to you is the exact same response that I gave to Mr. Lee, which was, Mr. Lee, I would love to invest in a mining project in Australia. You know, I love the sand and the surf and the wine and the food is great. No better place to go and do my due diligence trip rather than, you know, somewhere in northern Canada. But it's just on a relative basis, much more expensive. I can get the same asset in Canada or better for a third the price. So until Australia becomes less of a hothouse for domestic assets, I'll be going elsewhere. I hope someday that'll happen, but I'm not sure it will, because as we discussed right at the very beginning of our segment, all the mining investors seem to be Australia based and very much have an Australia domestic focus these days. So on a relative basis, it's hard to find value.
Is there any Australian ore bodies, whether they're in production or being developed, that would actually pass the Queen's Road filter test? Or is there not many out there at the moment in this country?
Olympic Dam.
Well, they don't even make money, do they?
but it's an incredible ore body. This will get unlocked. Copper and uranium in a multi-century ore body in South Australia. I'll take a piece of that any day of the week. We can make it work.
Now, if they didn't have to process the uranium on site and smelt the copper, I'm sure they'd make money. But they're very constrained by that, I think.
Warren, you've really emphasised the strength and the high-quality nature of ore bodies being the key feature that you look for. On the flip side of that, I want to hear how much management plays in your investment thesis. Do you think the ore body can just outweigh a bad management team?
At the end of the day, it has to, because there's always the risk that you do have a bad management team. But you hope that that doesn't happen. And when you make the first investment, you are very much making an investment in the existing management team almost as much as you are in the quality of the ore body. And that's important to us. And we demonstrate how important that is to us. We have in every one of our debentures a thing called voting alignment. And under the terms of voting alignment, in the event of a hostile takeover or an unwanted suitor, shall we say, and by the way, every single company we invest in, because of the quality of the ore body, it will eventually be likely subject to an unwanted suitor or a hostile takeover. So it's an appropriate topic for a discussion and addressing. Every single one of our converts in that scenario gives our votes to management. We're the only group in the world that does this. So in the event of a hostile takeover, we don't sell our shares to the highest bidder. We don't sell our shares to whoever is the first cab off the rank to give us a bid. We give the votes of our shares to the management team who we entrust to make the best decision, not just for Queen's Road, but for all shareholders and maximize our return. And we put that in writing. And I challenge you to find any other institution that gives that much backing and that much authority to an existing management team.
Warren, I want to get into the macro side of things now. You've obviously spent a long time in and around China. You're based in Hong Kong. You've got a relationship with people who've done significant amounts of investing in mainland China. So there's been a lot of discussion lately about the slowing property market, the impending slowdown of the Chinese economy, and naturally this has a huge amount of flow-on effect on the world of commodities. How do you sort of see it from your viewpoint, this whole Chinese slowdown debate?
We're definitely in the midst of it. There's definitely a big slowdown, and I expect it's going to get worse before it gets better. So that would suggest to me that not just copper prices, all base metal prices are going to have somewhat of a lull for the next year, maybe 18 months. And that, for us, is an absolutely tremendous opportunity, because hopefully it'll give us an opportunity to invest in some of these great ore bodies in the base metal sector. Because in the longer term, and Queen's Road is not a short-term investor, as I say, we commit our money for at least 5 years. In a five-year price environment, in the longer term, China will start to grow again. It'll solve its temporary financial ills. and there'll be a commodity storm for the rest of the decade. But China's difficulties right now give us a tremendous buying opportunity.
Is that commodity storm, is that going to be inspired by China like it has been again for the past two decades? Or do you see more growth out of the likes of India, Indonesia, Vietnam, and these sorts of nations as they go up the development curve?
Yeah, it's one of the things about the next commodities boom is it's going to be a much healthier one. It's going to be much more broadly based. We're going to have coordinated global growth. It's going to be in North America. It's going to be in Europe. It's going to be in emerging Asia. China will do its part. China will not be nearly as dominant as it was in the last boom. And that's a good thing. That's a healthy thing. So I think it's going to be more powerful and longer lasting. So as I say, tremendous opportunity.
And flowing on from that, you've made a comment in a previous interview that you've done about the cyclicality of commodities. I think you said every commodity has its sort of day in the sun. How does this sort of tie in with building a portfolio and spreading the risk across various commodities? How do you think about that?
Yeah, managing the diversity of the portfolio and managing the timing of the portfolio is very important. We want to have our fingers in a very, very few high quality pies, you know, where what you call a high conviction investor. I don't want to have, you know, right now we've got about 150 million in the portfolio in debentures, and that's spread across 7 different investments. It's not spread across 15 investments. I don't want 15 small bets. I want 7 to 10 big bets. And so when you have that sort of concentration in the actual names that you're investing in, you do want to get some diversification in terms of the commodity and manage the timing of your entrance into that commodity according to, as you say, macroeconomic factors. So that's a big part of it. The great thing about Queen's Road and being quote unquote commodity agnostic is that we can pick things that are out of favor. We're not a, you know, precious metal royalty company that always has to buy precious metal royalties, whether the cost of gold is very, very high or the cost is low. That's what we do, and I don't have any choice. I have the luxury of buying uranium when it's out of favor. I have the ability to time a gold investment when gold is out of favor, or at least when the gold equities are out of favor, as is the case right now. I don't have to go and buy a convert in a lithium company when lithium is at outrageous highs. I can wait for the next fall in lithium prices and time my entrance at the right point in time. So that degree of flexibility under the banner of being commodity agnostic, again, allows us to maximize returns for our shareholders.
Right, time to get the crystal ball out, Warren. Everyone looks to the leaders like yourself to just predict the future, and we're going to see what you come up with for the commodities specifically. So logical place to start for us at the moment is lithium, because it's absolutely running hot at the moment. You've got, in Australia anyway, you've got the Albemarle bid, takeover bid for Liontown. You've got MinRes front runner for Bald Hill. You've got Azure's new deposit. You've got every other bloody company tripling because they're next door to a lithium company. Then they shit themselves when they find out there's no lithium there. It's all going good. But you don't have, based on JD's notes, you don't have lithium exposure in your portfolio at the moment. Give us your take on why that is, and will that change?
Yeah. Excellent question. As I said, we're a long-term investor. Lithium has demonstrated over the course of the last 5 years a boom-bust sort of profile. I tend to get nervous about things that boom bust because they're not sort of compatible with being a long-term investor. The busts tend to be, or the booms tend to be short-term shortages. As we all know, lithium in the Earth's crust is pretty darn abundant. Price spikes tend to be brief moments of time when we're simply developing new sources of supply. It's not as if new sources of supply won't come on and don't exist. They will come on and they'll eventually flood your market. So I've never been a great fan of lithium investment for the longer term. That said, the industry does seem to be growing in terms of demand potential enough so that maybe structurally we are going to have long-term lithium price growth rather than boom bust. And so I've started to get interested over the last couple of years. We weren't going to make an investment last year because equity prices for lithium were sky high. As you note, Maddie, a lot of lithium equities have come off their highs. I can think of many that still have significant deposits, and they're down 70-80% from where they were a year ago. ASX listed names you're familiar with, and I won't name names, but those now have potential for Queen's Road investment simply because the equity values are starting to approach where we see long-term value. So we actually wrote our first lithium term sheet about 6 months ago to one of these companies that was well off its highs but has a very nice high-grade ore body. At the end of the day, because their ore body was so high quality, they just raised equity and went on with their life. I think we'll have another kick at that can because since then, their stock has come way off, just like all the others. And just like all the others, they need to raise more money, not only this year, but next year and the year after that. In one of those periods, we'll have an opportunity to invest where we see there's value. So I think it'll probably happen in the lithium sector, but as I say, it's a great thing about our structure is that we tend to avoid things that are hot, things that are sexy, things that are in fashion at the moment. Those are things that we avoid.
So would you say that the value proposition of an individual company would outweigh your, I guess, macro long-term view of what the lithium price is going to do? Whether you're going to start tickling in that basket a bit?
That's fair. I mean, it comes to the balance of quality of ore body versus wind at your back in terms of commodity price. But if I can get a piece of a great ore body with a commodity that I think is going to be okay longer term, that's still within our purview. Yep.
So what about copper, Warren? You've got your investment in Los Andes at the minute. And we keep hearing about this impending, you know, supply deficit. What's your view on copper and any investments in that space?
Yeah, that's Ellie, that raises another aspect of investing, which is even if you have the right ore body, if you can't get the right deal, then it's not a great investment, even though it's a great ore body. And for the last several years, that's been the challenge with copper. There are some very nice deposits out there, some very nice ore bodies that I would like a piece of. But the equity values have been so high that it's just turned us off from a valuation perspective. And even though copper is well down from its highs, that's still where we are right now. you know, copper may be at $3.75 a pound, but the equities are discounting a value of $4.50 or even higher a pound. So the equities aren't reflecting where the current copper price is, and certainly not reflecting where I expect copper prices will go in the next six months, which due to the travails in China, which we've already discussed, I expect, you know, the price of copper will weaken, not strengthen, in the next 6 months. We need the sun and the moon and the stars all to align at the right time when we make an investment. And part of that is the having the commodity price in a place where we're comfortable. But part of it also is to have the equity price in a place where we're comfortable. And right now, copper equities for good quality ore bodies are not in the right place. We hope that in the next 6 months, they will be.
What do you think about ore bodies like Wafi Gulpu, Casa Bell, probably Kamal Kakula, as copper ore bodies? Do you class them as world-class ore bodies, like these big, especially Casa Bell and Wafi Gulpu, these big block cave operations that require a lot of capital investment and time to start producing? What do you think of those ore bodies?
Yeah, they are world-class ore bodies. Certainly, you know, things like block caving and other mining methods are technically challenging, but it's not new technology. It can be done. It's a big boys game. So it tends to be better suited in the hands of, you know, the BHPs and the Newcrest Newmonts of the world. But would we like to have a piece of one of those ore bodies? Absolutely right. But we wouldn't want our investee company to develop it. You know, that's an incredibly big capital commitment and higher risk than normal, higher technical and financial risk. And I think the idea would be that if we could get a piece of that ore body in an independent company, we'd be happy to finance that company, but we'd eventually want them to put themselves up for sale and let someone else build it.
Warren, I want to get onto uranium now, and I'm fascinated to hear your response. Going off your latest report, over 50% of the invested portfolio is in uranium. You've got investments in ISO Energy and obviously NexGen, which we've touched on. What's your outlook on nuclear power and uranium? Like, can you hear the debate getting, you know, louder and louder for the place that nuclear has in a more sustainable future?
Yeah. Obviously, I've got a strong bias towards uranium, and I am very, very bullish about the role of nuclear in society and therefore the price of uranium. However, I do want to put it in context. You know, the original investment we made in NexGen, I made the original investment in CEF with Mr. Lee back in 2016. So that was almost 8 years ago. And when we made that investment, obviously uranium was very much out of favor. No one cared about it. Fukushima was a very recent event, relatively speaking, and nobody cared about uranium. Everyone thought that, Mr. Lee has a grand vision for uranium, and he's got a grand vision for nuclear development in China, and he's looking into his crystal ball, and he's foreseeing the reemergence of nuclear power in the world. And that wasn't at all the case. The investment had nothing to do with a bet on uranium or a bet on nuclear energy. It was driven 100% by the quality of that ore body. And every subsequent investment, and as you mentioned, I've actually done 6 convertible debentures with the NexGen group of companies. This one we announced last week is actually our 6th convertible into NexGen companies. Every single one of those has been about the ore body. However, they all just happened to benefit from this great wind at our back called the uranium price, which as the story continues to unfold, it just coincides with the best fundamental backdrop for uranium supply demand there's probably ever been in history. So we're very fortunate to have exposure to both a great ore body and an emerging great commodity.
There's one more commodity I want to ask you about, Warren. You've had a role with Niobec in the niobium market. So there's a few explorers out here that are making a few headlines. They're getting a bit of traction in the niobium space. And I want to hear from someone who's had a bit more than a couple months experience in the market. What are the sort of things you'll learn about the market that you wouldn't get on the first initial deep dive about the perhaps market dynamics and the like?
I love the niobium sector. You're right. I was on the board of Niobec, the Canadian niobium mine. There are only three mines on planet Earth, which is incredible. If I was to turn my phone around right now, I could show you my barrels of ferro-niobium and my niobium sample sitting in the office here. And not many mining engineers have those, because you don't get any exposure to the... I had been a mining engineer for 30 years before I ever went to visit my first and only niobium mine. Because once you visit one, you're not allowed to visit the others, because competition rules prevent you from even talking to the other producers. It's a very, very, very tiny industry. It's a fascinating industry. And it's an industry that has tremendous profit potential. It's one of the reasons why we bought the interest in the Niobec mine. You know, I mentioned earlier that Mr. Lee likes to be in industries that he can influence. The concept of buying into a mining industry, a sector of the industry where there are only three players, really appealed to him, because when you have three players, you know, maybe there's always the opportunity to reduce it down to two. Then you've got a duopoly in production of a critical material, and that appealed to him. So we bought Niobec in jointly with Temasek, 50-50, and it turned out to be a fabulous investment we made. You talk about those outsized returns that he was looking for. Well, Niobec was one of those outsized returns. The reason why there are only three niobium ore bodies in the world is metallurgy. And you're right, there have been some recent lovely discoveries and great grades, and that's all wonderful, and full recognition of that, and hats off to the guys. Challenge is always metallurgy. It's notoriously difficult to get recoveries of actual ferro-niobium. So they require a lot of work and they take time. So that's the only caveat I would give to all niobium explorers, is that it's great to get excited about headline numbers and grades and so on. But particularly with niobium, you know, there's metallurgical challenges and then there's marketing challenges, because the industry is controlled by this big boy down in Brazil called CBMM, and they don't take kindly to new entrants. So you have to find your niche. You have to find a way to market your material so that it's acceptable. But, you know, broadly speaking, love the industry, and I expect that Queen's Road will be involved in that industry in the future in some form.
Beautiful. How about we get into some specific stocks now? One that you've mentioned on the call already is Adriatic Metals, and we've interviewed the CEO and COO in the past. We've spoken about it at length. I want to hear how Bosnia fits in with your interest in investing exclusively in tier one locations or jurisdictions.
Yeah. Well, sometimes you take on a little bit more risk for the quality of ore body, and Adriatic was just that case. Incredible ore body. You know, as much as I have gone on already about NextGen and Aero, you know, wonderful ore body, fabulous ore body. At $50 a pound uranium, we've already blown through that. But according to the feasibility study, which was done at $50 a pound uranium, the IRR was sort of 50 to 60% at $50 a pound. The IRR at Adriatic was 100%. It was, yes, it's a smaller ore body, not as long life, but man, you get your capital return real, real fast. We talk about margin. Adriatic has huge margin, very, very quick payback, which is just what you look for in countries that are perhaps not quite tier one. So with Adriatic, the ore body certainly helped in that decision. But then when you take a closer look at Bosnia, Bosnia has been a very good place to operate. It's not well known in the mining environment, in the mining sector, but I think it will become better known. And it is part of the European community, and relationships are growing and getting closer. I think you'll be hearing more about Bosnia. So I think, although not tier one, it's pretty darn close. You know, when we made our investment into Adriatic, you mentioned the CEO, Paul. Paul said to me, Warren, well, we're going to use your money to complete the feasibility study, get our permits, and raise project finance. And we hope to have all that done in the next 2 years. And I said, oh, yeah, sure, Paul. That's great. That's great. If you need more money, come and see me. But, you know, we're here for the next 5 years. I didn't think he had a hope in hell of doing all of those things in a somewhat unknown jurisdiction like Bosnia. Guess what? He did it all in less than 1 year. He finished his feasibility study. He got fully permitted, and he arranged the project finance all within 1 year of taking Queen's Road's money. Tremendous accomplishment by Paul and the team at Adriatic, and reflects obviously very well on Bosnia as a future mining jurisdiction. So, you know, we've got nothing but good things to say about Adriatic. And as you know, the mill will be turning over in November. That's weeks away, and the cash flow will start to come.
Yeah, and the share price has been bearing fruit over that period as well. There was one other ASX-listed investment that you've made that I want to touch on, Challenger Exploration. So it's another one we've briefly spoken about. They've got two projects, both in Latin America, in Ecuador and Argentina. Firstly, which of those projects, or is it both projects, that attracted you guys to the company?
Very much Argentina. They've got a very high-grade skarn deposit surrounded by a lower-grade halo around that. And it's that really high-grade skarn that gets me very excited. That's a mine. There's no doubt that that's a mine, and it's going to be a high-margin mine, which is right up our alley. The lower-grade halo around it, and the Ecuador deposits, which are big but lower grade, will be added value in the right market. Right now, it's not the right market, but there's extra value there that we and the company will realize over time. But the actual deposit at Challenger is a beautiful high-grade deposit.
Beautiful. Well, I think we're close to wrapping up, guys. Why don't we get into an overrated, underrated?
Overrated. This is the always the great conclusion to a show when we've got an expert like yourself on, Warren. Overrated, underrated. One word answers. Underrated means you like it, you see promise. Overrated means don't like it, don't believe in it. Essentially, I could say, I didn't want to say you think it's shit, but we can imply that that's what overrated means. We're going to...
I'll do what I can without offending anyone.
Just say, yeah, just simple one word, overrated or underrated or neutral, or don't want to comment, don't know enough about it, but we know that that's not going to be your case, being a guru, mate. I'll lead it away. We'll go one east. Azure Minerals.
One word? I have to do it in one word?
Underrated or overrated or neutral?
Frothy.
WA1.
Underrated in the long term.
Mm.
Centaurus.
Yeah, neutral.
Chile as a jurisdiction, not the food.
Underrated.
Sol Gold, the company.
Pass.
Ooh.
I'm not going to offend.
F3 Uranium Corp.
Underrated.
De Grey.
Underrated.
Ooh.
Greatland Gold.
Underrated.
Uranium.
Underrated.
Oh, I could have picked that one.
That's easy. No brainer.
Albemarle's $6.6 billion bid for Liontown.
Oh, crazy. Overrated.
Namibia as a jurisdiction.
Underrated.
Lithium.
Overrated.
Ooh. India as a jurisdiction, and in the context of maybe taking over China as the biggest fasting growing economy.
Overrated.
West Africa in general as a mining jurisdiction.
Just simply no go. Uninvestable, as they say.
And lastly, Filo Mining.
Oh, fabulous. Underrated.
Mate, sensational. And we Beautiful. Always congratulate the guests that can do an underrated, overrated in one word like you did. You absolutely nailed it, Warren.
Yep, nailed it.
Love it, mate. Mate, now after this, what I've come to believe about yourself and your company is I'm comparing you to Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie. You probably get a lot of approaches, but you just have to knock a lot back. Is that? I think it's a great summary of the business with the condo. How many approaches do you get, and how many do you have to knock back with these convertible notes due to your I guess your stringent filter test? There'd be more going out than coming in.
You know, Matty, I really the phone doesn't ring off the hook, even at times when the market is tough like it is now. You know, I get lots of inbounds, but it doesn't ring off the hook. I think people know that I'm really, really, really picky. And so they know that chances are that I'm just going to say, well, sorry, guys, it just doesn't fit our bill. I still have lots of time, free time in the office because there aren't that many good things to look at.
Well, beautiful. Mate, we'll have to keep a close eye on what you guys invest in next.
Mate, absolutely ripping interview, mate. Yeah. I'm fascinated by all that. We really appreciate your time. That was absolutely awesome.
Yeah, thanks.
I hope you enjoyed it, Warren. As much as
thanks,
we did, Warren. Mate.
Well, I enjoyed it thoroughly, and now that I've experienced it, I'm going to have to be a regular tuning in and hearing the other interviews. Great fun.
Oh, we'd be flattered if that was the case, mate. Thanks so much again. And we'd look in future, I'm sure we'd love to have you on again. We'd absolutely be thrilled. So thanks again, mate.
Much appreciated, Warren.
Cheers, Warren.
Thank you.
The information contained in this episode of Money of Mine is of general nature only and does not take into account the objectives, financial situation, or needs of any particular person. Before making any investment decision, you should consult with your financial advisor and consider how appropriate the advice is to your objectives, financial situation, and needs.